Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
You know, that is so right. We at AppSats.org feel that the disclosure is 100% part of the beginnings of working with a partner and the sex addict and establishing safety. You've got to have the truth. And the only way you can have the truth is if somebody works with the sex addict and gets an entire timeline of his sexual acting out, so that then you know what you're dealing with. Now, we really feel it's imperative to have a polygraph after that disclosure, because what we know to be true is even if a sex addict wants to be honest, they're going to have a tendency to minimize the amount of information they give because they think, why? What good is it that she knows that I was with 43 prostitutes? I'll just tell her it was 27. Or I really don't have to tell her that I went into my child's bedroom 3 times and thought about touching him, because I didn't do it. So I don't need to give her that information. Well, you know, I'm not here to say that sex addicts molest their children in any way, shape, or form. But exploitation is a type of sexual addiction. It happens at a small percentage of sexual addiction acting out. And if your husband thought about it, went into the room, whether he actually molested or not, isn't that something that you want to know, you deserve to know, you need to know to keep your kids safe? So we highly recommend disclosures, but they have to be formal and they have to be done by trained professionals. I have worked with so many partners and sex addicts that thought they were getting a disclosure, and it turned out to be a fiasco. It wasn't set up where either person knew what to expect. It was bullet points as opposed to a well-written out 12, 15, 18, 25-page narrative. There was no accountability. They didn't know that they could be polygraphed, so they did not try to be honest. It was done in an hour. I set up 3 hours for my disclosure. I want to give this couple an accurate amount of time to not only go through closure, but because she probably has questions that the disclosure has brought up that she's written down during that process, she needs to be able to ask those questions. So there needs to be extra time to go over what she's heard. And I have to help her with that because more than likely she's shell-shocked. She's traumatized, and she may even be having a trauma reaction. So I have to make sure that she's getting the information she needs and is adequately responding to it to the best of her ability. For any of you that are listening that perhaps have gone through a discovery and you're wondering about a disclosure, I want you to know it's part of the whole treatment process for addicts, for partners, and for the coupleship. Can't stress it enough. And you know, the other thing that I really believe is that when things are done purposefully and intentionally, wow, then the partner does much better. You know, she knows what to expect, and she does a better job of figuring out what she needs to do next. You've heard me say it before. There are 3 aspects to the treatment, to healthy treatment for a partner that's partner-sensitive, and that is that we keep her safe and stabilized, and then we help her grieve what she didn't know, what she's experiencing now, and the loss of what she thought she had. And then last but not least, we help her restore her sense of self, her sense of reality, and if she so desires, we help her to restore the coupleship. And that is no easy task. So you got to have people that have been trained to know how to do it the most effectively. Now, I got to tell you, we've got a real treat today. We have Judy Kelly, who's a licensed clinical social worker, a certified sex addiction therapist. She's also a trauma therapist, and she studied under Dr. Brené Brown. So she is a certified Daring Greatly and Rising Strong facilitator. And what that means is that she is an expert at emotional self-regulation and shame resiliency. So she literally can help you to understand how to get through the emotional self-regulation you need to when you're dealing and reeling from sexual addiction. And, you know, I had her on my other show, which is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and this was just such a fascinating topic. You know, we really need to understand what shame's about. And addicts feel shame because of the behaviors they've participated in, and then they feel shame because of the trauma that they've caused their wives. Well, I got to tell you, partners feel traumatized, and they feel shame too, because they wonder if they did something to contribute to this. They wonder if they weren't good enough. They wonder if they're doing the right thing to try to work through this with the addict. Or if they choose not to work through it, they have shame about not wanting to stick in there and work through it. They're wondering if they're doing the right things for their family if they stay, and they wonder if they're doing the right things for their family if they leave. And, you know, shame is a natural response to really feeling bad about yourself. We all know that the difference between guilt and shame is that guilt is when you know you've done something wrong. But shame is when you feel you are bad or you are wrong. And so, you know, one of the things that I wanted Judy to come on the show and talk about was how do we help partners to regulate their emotions when truly it feels like their whole world has fallen apart? And what types of techniques does she use? Because I want you to know what those things are so that you can use them at home, so that you can teach them to your therapist, so that you can help your therapist remind you to utilize them. And, you know, it's part of that feeling safe. And, again, that's the exciting part to beginning to heal, is when you start to feel safe and you start to feel resilient again. So we try to get the experts on that really know what it is that makes a difference in the recovery of partners and sex addicts. And so today's going to be a really good show. I can't wait. Now, you may wonder, how do I find a partner-sensitive clinician or coach? And so I want to tell you, you go to appsats.org and you put in your own city and state. And up will pop, you know, up will come out all the names of people within a certain radius. And if you can't find somebody in your area, you know, we are working hard at training as many clinicians and coaches as we can. We've almost got a full class for our training that occurs in Cincinnati, Ohio, in November. Actually, that would be the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th. If you're a clinician or a coach and you want to find out more about this training, we do them via webinars and we do them via face-to-face trainings. And this one's face-to-face. It's in Cincinnati, Ohio. And you can go to appsats.org and find out more about that too. I just happen to be one of the trainers. There are three of us, incredible trainers. Barbara Steffens, the president of the APSATS organization, and the woman that wrote My Sexually Addicted Spouse. She's the founder and got this whole process together. And then we have Dr. Sherry Keffer, who just wrote an amazing book called Intimate Deception. And she talks about her experience of being a partner and what it was like to be a partner, get her PhD, and train others on partner betrayal. And then we got me, a clinician and a coach who has made it her mission for the last, 12 years to work with addicts and their partners, and especially the coupleship. If you want to restore the coupleship, I'm here to help you. Now, if there isn't somebody in your area, there are people that work online. They will help you. You know, I definitely coach couples on how to develop empathy. There's plenty of us. Several of them are also a part of BTR. You know, the coaching staff of BTR, which is another wonderful podcast, whereby, you know, you can get advice, you can be in groups, you can do trainings. I mean, it's just kind of a world that is opening up to partners, and we're really excited to see it. It really helped when the World Health Organization was able to include a category that had to do with compulsive problematic sexual behavior. When they did that, and we could statistically code that diagnosis, we will then be able to get treatment facilities and, you know, whether they be outpatient or inpatient, to not only be able to code for their services, but to be able to reimburse for their services. And that's unfortunately what it's all about, you know. Treatment centers and therapists and coaches want to get paid. And if insurance can help defray the cost to you, that's what we want. I think you can understand that. So, again, excited to be able to help you to get the help you need, the healing that you need, so that clearly you're not in this alone. You've got other people that are on your team and willing to do the hard work to make your life better. That's what the show's all about, and that's what AppSats is all about, and it really is an amazing organization. So, go to APSATS.org, and I'm sure you will find that you can get the help you deserve with partner-sensitive trauma specialists and coaches that obviously know to take your situation and to give you absolutely the treatment that you deserve and need. Now, one of the things that I believe is that partners do deserve specialized treatment, and that's why Judy Kelly has made it her mission to help people in general, but addicts and partners, to feel that sense of emotion regulation and shame resiliency. And she wants to help sex addicts and partners in their recovery. And so I am always thrilled when I get to work with Judy because she has so much to offer the world. Judy, welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. How are you?
Thank you, Carol. I'm wonderful. How are you doing? Battling the tail end of a cold, but I'm doing well.
Oh, boy. That's where I was last week. I understand that. and I'm doing really well because, you know, this show invigorates me. I'm so happy that partners are able to access the right services, the right approaches that take their life to the next level. And, you know, not only are you a CSAT, a Certified Sexual Addiction and Trauma Therapist, but you also have studied with Brené Brown and done the Certified Daring Greatly and Rising Strong work. So tell me a little bit about how you got interested in working with sex addicts and partners.
Well, how I got interested in working sex addicts and partners, that's a great question, Carol. Actually, my background is in my earlier work, I used to direct the Placer County Child Sexual Abuse Treatment Program. So it was really in that kind of work that was kind of my area of expertise and working with, you know, issues around sexual abuse and physical and emotional abuse and family of origin issues, both with adults and with children, and, you know, helping to restore families. And I'd always had a private practice. And a man came into my private practice one day, and he actually was referred to me from a colleague that knew I had done, you know, a number of years of work around sexual abuse treatment, in particular with males and females. But and he came into my office, and he had been arrested by the police for exposing himself in the community. And so I was, you know, I started to work with him, and I thought, okay, I got this. And, you know, I know it's, you know, unresolved trauma, and there's a lot of work to do, and there's probably trauma repetitiveness and all of that. And so as I began to work with him, though, and unpacking some of these things, I realized, oh, my goodness, this is a different thing altogether. You know, the components of everything that he was presenting, I realized that this was something that would require more information. So I called a colleague of mine who was a CSAT, and she said, oh, Judy, you need to go get your CSAT. This is one of those cases where that would be really helpful. So a number of years ago, I ran to work with Patrick Carnes, and I was one of the lucky ones that got to be trained when he was doing the trainings himself solely, got to be trained by him, and worked this case, saw this gentleman for about 4 years, actually just got a Christmas card from him last year, and he said he's doing fabulous, and thank you so much, and Yeah, and he really was one of those that really did the work, he and his wife and his family, and that's kind of how I got into it, really.
Well, you know, obviously, you did the work you needed to do to be able to help him. This is such a specialized field, and I'm not saying that other counselors that don't have our background can't work with somebody, but we do it more effectively, more expediently, and we know the resources available. A lot of people don't. So obviously you went
right
the education to be able to work with this man, and I love the fact that he sent you a holiday card because he wanted to let you know how he was doing it. It's really all about relationships, isn't it, Judy?
Yes, it absolutely is. And that's a great point, Carol. I was talking with a colleague of mine the other day who's also a CSAT, and I'm sure that you see this in your practice as well, that very well-meaning therapists that are really seasoned, competent, wonderful clinicians unintentionally will work outside their scope of practice. And, you know, we sometimes get clients where they've been doing couples therapy and, you know, a secret is being held for 2 years. And then finally it gets discovered and they feel like, you know, especially the partner feels like they've wasted all this time in not working around the real core issue that was being held a secret the entire time because the therapist didn't know what to ask or what to look for, you know, to kind of do some secret busting to see what was really going on. Or people that aren't trained CSATs, and that's not to criticize our profession, but I would never work outside my scope of practice if somebody came to me and said, I have a chronic eating disorder, I would instantly refer them to somebody that has expertise in that area. And sometimes, you know, therapists, they don't know that they don't know. And that can be a dangerous and unhelpful thing to partners and addicts. So I'm glad that you're out there. I'm glad I'm out there. I'm glad that other CSATs are out there to help this population that's in great need.
Well, absolutely. And so I want to talk to you about the fact that you are such a self-learner. I mean, talk to us a little bit about the need for emotional self-regulation in sex addiction and partner recovery. How did you first get involved with that?
Well, years ago, I studied as a somatic therapist in addition to being a CSAT and all of that because I just so believe that our wiring, you know, we have to work from a body-centered, heart-centered, cognitive depth, you know, embracing all those avenues of healing, and they all so much work together. And so when I first, you know, and I know you get that as a fellow CSAT, I think that emotional self-regulation is important for all of us as human beings and certainly for people really struggling with sex addiction. And I see, you know, when people first come to my office, they're struggling with sex addiction. They got discovered by their wife or their partner, or maybe they lost a job or they got arrested, like the gentleman I was referring to earlier. Something threw them into crisis. And so, you know, we get that first urgent phone call from the wife or partner or addict upon discovery or right around discovery. And whether I'm seeing the addict or the betrayed partner, one of the things that we both know, Carol, is that both of them have really active PTSD going on when they show up and upon discovery. And so in addition to providing a thorough clinical assessment for the sex addict or the partner involved in this terrible betrayal trauma and, you know, working through a treatment plan and assessment and treatment recommendations and all of that, part of the immediate emotional relief and support I believe clients really need is helping them to build some kind of external and internal emotional container so that they, you know, it's paramount for both addicts and partners with that active PTSD to begin to feel safe within themselves and eventually in being able to emotionally engage with each other in safe and respectful ways. during the crisis stage, I mean, people are just bouncing off the walls. It is so traumatic, and people feel so powerless, and partners feel so desperate, and they're living their life, and all of a sudden, you know, they get the rug pulled out from underneath them and end up in a place that they never thought they would be, and it's painful and chaotic and terrifying. And there's traumatic memories and triggers, and the intense feelings feel almost unbearable at times for folks. So I think the beginning aspect of working with people, the need for emotional self-regulation, helps people to build, you know, an initial emotional container to help them get that, get back that sense of feeling somewhat normal under very, very difficult circumstances, and feeling more contained within themselves.
Well, you know, you talk about container, and I know that I do. I move into sensitization reprocessing, or EMDR, and we're always asking our clients to help us to understand what would make them feel safe and give them those resources that will help them feel safe as they begin to do some of that trauma work and reprocess a lot of the feelings they've had. When do you start teaching clients about emotional self-regulation, and what do you believe are the benefits?
Yeah, well, I really, right from the very beginning, you know, once I, you know, I give clients an intake history, but honestly, we don't go through, you know, with partners, I agree with Rob Weiss and probably you, I'm sure, and others that, you know, I will get to childhood history and all that probably a year down the road, quite honestly. Partners need immediate resourcing, regulation, and help from the very beginning. So one of the things I like to do is really work with them about doing some initial psychoeducation about the brain and the body and feelings and how they all work together in response to trauma, because they need to know how to self-regulate when they're not sitting in my office. You know, I mean, I see them an hour and a half a week, so they need to know what are the tools and skills that they can use to help them to notice when they get dysregulated. So, you know, one of the things I explain to clients that when we're treating trauma, we need to, you know, wake up what we call the thinking brain and the noticing brain, that part of us that can be curious about what's happening inside. And I remember when I first trained with Patrick Carnes, one of the things he said that always stuck with me is whether you're treating the addict or the partner, hold on to their frontal lobes and don't let go. And, you know, the reason being is that our brains get so hijacked in response to trauma and our frontal lobes go offline. And so we experience all those intensely emotional feelings and triggers. So for partners especially, this can happen, as you know, numerous times a day or numerous times an hour or numerous times a minute. So what I like to teach every client is something that I call, I got from Janina Fisher's work and Pat Ogden's work in somatic psychotherapy. It's the window of tolerance. And I ask clients to just imagine, and I have these great psychoeducational charts that Janina Fisher put out, and trained as a somatic therapist, so, I really believe in this. I ask clients to really imagine that they have this imaginary window, feeling window, sort of inside themselves, so imagining this big square inside themselves that looks like a real window. And asking them, and I use this the charts to describe and show them, but for your audiences, to ask them to imagine dividing this window that lives inside themselves into three separate sections. So imagine a line running horizontally at the top of the window, so there's like a space going across the top, and we call that area the area of hyperarousal. And then there's the middle part of the window we call the optimal arousal zone. That's kind of the optimal feeling zone where we feel more balanced and clear thinking and feeling and less less out of the window. So the optimal feeling window is the center of the window. And then the third space and the line towards the bottom of the window we call hypoarousal. So after experiencing trauma, and for our partners, this is the discovery, this is everything that they're dealing with, our nervous system remains prepared for danger now. We went from a place that we thought was reasonably safe to now this scary place that feels really dangerous, and we're in this heightened emotional response pattern. So in other words, when we experience this intense emotional reaction that's so hard to regulate, we will often go outside the center or the middle part of the window, and we'll flip out the top, which is the hyperarousal, or we'll flip out the bottom of the window, which is the hypoarousal. So I teach people how to stay in that middle window in the optimal arousal zone, which can be extremely challenging and sometimes feel really almost impossible in the early stages. And how to, if we do go outside the window, how to navigate our way back into the center of the window. Because that's, we want that to become sort of eventually our new normal. Because once they're flooded through landing in hyperarousal or hypoarousal, it's a very painful, difficult place to be. So three parts, chronic hyperarousal at the top, so the optimal arousal zone or window of tolerance, same thing, the safe place is in the middle, and then the chronic hypoarousal at the bottom of the window. So the thing about the middle window is we can think and feel simultaneously, and our reactions and behaviors are contained. And the important thing is that our thinking, our feelings, and our behaviors are all present, and we know it. Our frontal lobes are engaged, they're intact, and so we know we're being triggered instead of falling deep into the trigger. There's a knowingness. We call that the noticing brain. So we notice, oh my God, here I am. It's where we feel more centered, balanced, and in control of ourselves, but that doesn't mean we can't feel all those really powerful feelings. We can still be really angry, have a lot of pain, a lot of shame, a lot of humiliation, loneliness, grief, but it's all connected, if that makes sense. So there's an awareness that we know we're being triggered rather than moving into the trigger. So our frontal lobes are online. We know we're pissed off enough that we can punch a wall, but we don't, because that's why I always tell people, think through the trigger. And even, you know, encourage people, I'm sure you do this too, just even tapping your forehead and telling yourself, I'm going to think through this trigger, so that you can actually go up in your head and try to reengage your brain. So signs of chronic hyperarousal when we go outside the window at the top, that is where that emotional overwhelm is. So hyperarousal can be things like panic, that we're overly emotionally saturated. We may be screaming, yelling, impulsive, defensive, hypervigilant. We feel really unsafe, you know, rageful, angry, racing thoughts, to name a few. And in the fight, flight, freeze response, this is often referred to as maybe the fight response. So at the bottom of the window, we have hypoarousal, which is the opposite extreme. So we can look at that as feeling numb, feeling dead, passive, like in a trance state, dissociating. We can't think. We're disconnected, shut down emotionally. We're feeling collapsed, depressed. And I always tell addicts and partners, nothing good ever happens when we are in hyper or hypoarousal. And I firmly believe that when sex addicts act out, they are in one of those two spaces. They are either in hyper or in hypoarousal, where their brains are getting hijacked and they're really offline. And they can, you know, so they act out in hyperarousal because there's too much emotional overwhelm for them to know how to self-regulate. So they act out because it's their desperate, unconscious way of trying to emotionally regulate themselves at times. And that's not to exclude the addict's behavior. You know, they need to learn how to identify, identify their feelings. A lot of addicts don't know how to do that. They don't know how to express and sit with the discomfort of their feelings. And so that's why I say you either talk it out or it gets acted out. So,
And so I'm curious because you mentioned that one technique about if you can feel that you're outside of your window of tolerance, if you can be the observer and tap on your forehead and remind yourself that you can think through this trigger. That's obviously a great tapping technique that helps to ground you to the here and now, and also reminds you that you have the power to work through the trigger as opposed to having the trigger hijack you. And so often for partners, that's what happens. Their triggers hijack them. They don't know what to do with it. Do you have any other techniques that you use, you know, in terms of resourcing and emotional self-regulation?
I do, actually. I do a number of them. One of the things that I do is, you know, along with the tapping and tapping your forehead to say, that was then, this is now, meaning right now what's going on. So looking around, I ask clients to look around and look at objects around them. Right now, it's a beautiful sunny afternoon. Right now, I am looking at the sun. I am looking at the sky. Right now, I can see the clouds above, or if you're in your house. Right now, I can look at, there's my stack of books, or there's that sweet picture of me and my daughter. Right now, I'm sitting on my cozy couch. Right now, I have a blanket around me. There's the lamp. There's the floor. So doing naming objects is one of the things I ask people to do. Name objects about, you know, where are you at right now? Right now, it's Sunday, or what is it today? Thursday, October 25th, and I'm sitting in my office, and I'm talking to Dr. Carol on the phone, and I'm talking about recovery with her for partners, and, you know, I can acclimate myself back to the here and now. So that's one thing I do. Another thing that I do is I love breathing techniques, and so one thing that I teach partners and addicts, but that I think is partners find really helpful, I do this in the Daring Greatly and the Rising Strong workshops as well, but I do it every day with partners, is box breathing. And I don't know if I talked about this last time, but it's the type of breathing that is used with Brené Brown references it, that she was interviewing a Navy SEAL guy, and he was saying, well, this is what we do with the Navy SEALs. We use this box breathing to help them regulate because they're going into these really dangerous, risky situations, and they need to know how to stay in their body and not go offline. So the box breathing, again, it's a window. I obviously like windows and squares. It's a box breathing. You imagine an imaginary box, you know, with four sides. So box breathing helps reconnect us to the parasympathetic nervous system. So what we can do when we are in hyperarousal or feel like we're starting to go there, we breathe in to the count of four through our nose. So we breathe in to the count of four, and at the top of the breath, we hold the breath to the count of four. So hold. Then we release to the count of four through our mouth. And then we stay empty to the count of four. So it creates a box. So going up the left side of the box one more time, breathing into the count of four. Hold. Release. And then stay empty to the count of four. And that those are just pretty simple techniques, but there's a number of them to use, you know, when people are in that place of highly, you know, high dysregulation.
Well, I know you said that you felt like that breathing technique was especially helpful to the parasympathetic nervous system. Will you share with our listening audience, what does that mean? Because they oftentimes hear about their parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, it's that part of us that can get so so dysregulated. There is a actually, I have my charts right here. What happens is that our nervous system gets we go into that fight, flight, and freeze, and we feel as though, you know, it's not safe. So our parasympathetic nervous system, when it isn't safe to flee or fight or freeze, what happens is we have all these physiological responses that can lead to physical collapse or exhaustion or weakness or shaking and trembling. And we go into these survival responses, and it creates this neurochemical release that actually triggers that. So what we need to do is we need to get back to the place where we can stop having those physiological symptoms, because what happens is we get triggered. It sounds off an alarm, so to speak. So the alarm is in the amygdala. The amygdala part of our brain, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm in danger. And our body and our senses can't tell that we are in danger, whether we're in danger right now or whether we're in danger from before. So let me give you this quick example. So I saw a guy that was in Desert Storm one time, and I was working with him in session. And he was talking about some of the things that he had experienced in Desert Storm. And as I was talking to him, I was in a chair, he was on the couch, and as I was talking to him, a car backfired. And he immediately went into a fetal position onto the floor. And so his body went into that really scary hyper-arousal place of, he actually went into the freeze. You know, the freeze is, I want to react, oh my God, I can't react. So he collapsed, went into the freeze, and we can do this. We can go from hyperarousal to hypoarousal, back to hyperarousal in the fight, flight, and freeze response. And what we want to do is restore the body to safety. So I asked if I got on the floor with him and sat next to him. I asked if it was okay if I touched his shoulder, and he said yes. And so I did, I won't go into all that I did, but I did a lot of grounding techniques to help him know that he was more in the here and now, and that was then and this is now, and it wasn't happening right now. So fast forward a year from then, he was sitting in the exact same place in my office. We were having a session. He knew about his nervous system and how his nervous system goes into that defense pattern and how to, you know, re-regulate himself. And almost the exact same sound happened. And a car backfired, or there was some noise outside my office window, and he looked at me and he said, took a big breath, and he said, Judy, and he made eye contact with me, so because that external regulation of safe people is also a very helpful thing we can do, is externally regulate people before they can internally regulate themselves. But he looked at me and he said, I know that's just a trigger. I know it's not happening right now. I can be curious about it. I can be aware of it. I can stay in the window, and I'm okay. And that was then and this is now. And he looked around my office because he went right into all the techniques he learned. So he was really able to emotionally self-regulate himself. And I use tracking sheets for that too. You know, that's one of the important things, is for people to identify their physiological symptoms. For instance, in hyperarousal, we can have increased heart rate, rapid or shallow breathing, holding their breath. I kind of liken it to a hamster on a hamster wheel, where there's lots of circular activity but no actual forward movement. And, you know, the fight, flight, and freeze. And then for hypoarousal, you know, it's more of that feeling numb, dead, passive, disconnected, and all of that. So from here, once folks understand their own window of tolerance and their physiological responses, they can then identify, okay, I'm in this place, I'm in hyper, I'm in hypo, and these are the tools and skills that I need to use to get back into my safe zone. So, yeah, things like breath work, thinking cues, body positions, holding positions. I like this thing called tapas pose, where you put your right hand on your forehead and your left hand on the back of your occipital bone. That feels very nurturing and holding and containing. Some people choose to kind of not pinch, but sort of pinch the bridge of their nose, and then with their right hand and hold their left hand on the back of their skull where the occipital bone is. All these things are just really practicing taming these trauma triggers. And here's the other thing I think of too, is that in terms of the window of tolerance, we all have big T traumas and little T traumas. And, so in other words, if clients growing up experienced physical, sexual, or severe emotional abuse or neglect, if they were raised in families that were rigid, controlling, too permissive, or they didn't feel loved, or maybe they felt loved, but their parents were too busy, a small emotional window can get created. And that's why addicts, you know, can numb out and engage in intensive, you know, pleasure-seeking behaviors and get hooked on the avoidance of feelings because they're used to it. They end up living this delayed life, so to speak. So the good news is we are not stuck with a small emotional feeling window, whether that's due to childhood abuse and neglect, and then, you know, further numbing and acting out in addictive behaviors such as sex addiction, or if it has shrunk in response to, you know, with partners being in this terrible relational traumatic betrayal, we can expand that window and enlarge that window and learn how to stay in our bodies, stay in our brains, stay in our hearts, and still be able to do the work at hand. And that's, you know, we have to be in that place to be able to feel solid and safe and have that emotional container inside ourselves to be able to do the therapy that is ahead of them. The good news is we can grow new neural pathways in our brain and learn new ways of being in the world and get back to, you know, the people we were truly meant to be before all this traumatic stuff happened. So one of the ways I love giving clients different opportunities to do this, after they get, you know, after clients are able to, you know, after they get through the crisis stage and they begin healing of the sex addiction and the betrayal trauma, they've done their formal disclosures, their therapeutic conferences, you know, the partners have the opportunity to do their victim impact letters, and there's a little emotional stability going on, and they've gotten through, you know, the first, you know, 6 months of the really horrid, hard parts. One of the things I really like to do is do Daring Greatly workshops with, you know, folks in recovery and partners, because it's such an important aspect to be able to practice some of the tools and skills that they're going to then learn in Daring Greatly workshops.
I'm glad you mentioned those because obviously several times a year you put on your own workshops that highlight Daring Greatly and Rising Strong. Do you have anything that's coming up in the near future?
You know, thanks for asking, Carol. I actually just did a Daring Greatly workshop a couple weeks ago with a number of folks. Not everybody was in recovery, but there were people that were sex addicts in recovery and their partners, and it was pretty profound. I mean, they typically are. I do these workshops once or twice a year, the Daring Greatly workshops, and I'm going to do a Rising Strong workshop exclusively for men and a Rising Strong workshop exclusively for women, all those are going to take place after the first of the year at this point. But I love...
Well, how can people find out more about that and get the dates and get registered for them?
Okay, they can go to my website. They can email me or go to my website. My website is www.judithckelly.com. So I'll repeat that, www.judithckelly.com. That's my website. They can also email me at judykellylcsw@gmail.com, or they can call me at 916-783-3420.
So literally, if people are liking what they're hearing and they believe that this would benefit them, even if you don't have the exact dates of the workshop, they could email you or call you and get on a list, and you would keep them posted about the next workshop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have a running email list of, you know, folks that are really interested in taking the Daring Greatly and Rising Strong workshops. And here's the thing that I love about them is they really help men and women to learn these kind of tools and skills that they never got. I mean, if you think about it, if they're doing these numbing behaviors by way of acting out sexually, they clearly don't know how to sit with and be with their feelings. So it helps people identify and experience and express feelings. In the workshops, we work a lot with honesty, transparency, authenticity, vulnerability. A lot of addicts are terrified of being vulnerable. We work a lot with shame resilience, self-compassion, and all these things are a practice. I think everything in life is a practice, and, you know, a lot of addicts don't even know that what their feelings are. I hear that every day. And so even identifying and practicing their feelings and then learning how to sit in the discomfort of hearing their partner's feelings is really, really important. We are, you know, it's really about rewiring their brain in more of a feeling present state, which is what they've been running from all their life. So just
absolutely.
Yeah.
And especially if they're experiencing shame. I know we only have about 3 or 4 more minutes, but so much of your work helps people to become shame resilient. So will you just spend a few minutes talking about that?
Sure. Shame is, Brené Brown talks about the definition of shame is that intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Shame is not productive and it's not very helpful. Unlike guilt, guilt is a motivator for change. Shame is not. And I was thinking about this morning, Carol, how partners really, their primary struggle is some shame and profound pain and profound humiliation, which is you know, having something done to you that you absolutely did not deserve. So shame, secrecy, silence, and judgment all fuel shame. And shame resilience is the practice of learning to recognize our shame and speaking our shame. Because when we do that, we reduce shame. And shame is one of those things, you know, in our life, you hear people being comfortable talking about, I'm angry, I'm hurt, I'm disappointed, I'm frustrated, I'm sad, I'm happy. But typically we don't hear people saying, I'm in a world of shame right now. And why is that? I mean, I think that shame, the way we help with shame resilience is shame needs to be spoken, and that's one of the ways that we reduce it. So the 4 elements of practicing shame resilience in a nutshell would be, and these, again, help with developing new neural pathways that we talked about earlier. So the first thing is we need to learn to recognize our shame physiologically and understand our shame triggers. So physiologically, for me, I get a red face, I might get a rash on my neck, my heart beats faster, I feel small, insignificant, invisible, unimportant. Those are kind of, you know, I feel like a child. It's a child state when we're really in our shame. So we need to practice shame resilience by learning to recognize our shame when we're in it. The second thing is we need to practice critical awareness, which is understanding how it exists and how it shows up in our life and in our relationships and really owning it. The third thing is we need to reach out and tell our story with people that have earned the right to hear it. And this is one of the things that happens in 12-step groups. Doing this in whatever way we choose to can really help increase our shame resilience. Shame hates to be spoken. And just like shame grows in secrecy, silence, and isolation, it hates to be spoken, and it shrinks when we name it and speak our shame. So that's the fourth thing, is speaking our shame, coming out of the secrecy and silence. We get to practice not only building resilience, but also communicating that to people, and them having an opportunity to practice compassion, courage, while listening and supporting us.
Oh, I love that. Judy Kelly, you are amazing. I hope that our listening audience will get on that list to hear more about your workshops, to find out the resources that you have available for them. And, you know, I just so appreciate the fact that here you are, a CSAT, a Certified Sexual Addiction Therapist, and you have also really appeal to the partners. You understand their pain. You understand their shame, their humiliation, and you want to help them feel safe. And at appsats.org, our training organization, that is the first stage of restoration of self, is to create safety and stabilization. So thank you so much for putting it out there and helping them and working so hard at making our clients feel safe.
Thank you so much. I think partners are heroes. I really think that they are heroines, and I acknowledge them from the bottom of my heart. So thank you very much.
I hear that 100%. Keep us posted and let us know when the next workshop is so that we can have you back on, okay?
Okay. Thanks so much, Carol.
All right. You have
Take
a great
care.
Day.
Thanks. Uh-huh. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, again, that was Judy Kelly. And she can be reached at 916-783-3420. You can just Google her, and she's all over the place. She is a woman who really believes in diversifying. And anybody who has that somatic experiencing background gets how this trauma takes hold and the body keeps score. And we want you to feel safe, and we want you to have all the resources available to make your life your own. Well, that's it for today's show, but I look forward to being with you next week. And as I say at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And we will be talking to you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio through appsats.org.
For more information, go to appsats.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.